Welcome to Native America Calling. From Skype in Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. One of the founders of the American Indian Movement, a champion of education and language revitalization, and an award-winning hoop dancer were just a few of the notable Native Americans who walked on this year. It's a particularly challenging year with the pandemic taking more than 300,000 lives in the United States, and some families lost multiple members. Today, we're remembering those who died in 2020. We're back right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders are calling for the full restoration of Bears Ears National Monument in Utah. The Trump administration slashed its size 3 years ago, but the Navajo Nation and others hope the next administration will reverse the order. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez, along with several tribal and county officials in Utah, want President-elect Joe Biden to reestablish the monument's nearly 2 million acre original size after he takes office next month. During the 2020 campaign, Biden signaled he may use the Antiquities Act to restore Bears Ears and the nearby Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which was shrunk by half in 2017. The former vice president has also suggested his administration could make even more conservation designations in the West. The Navajo, Hopi, Zuni, Ute Indian Tribe, and Ute Mountain Ute Tribe make up the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. They say the area is their ancestral home, and they depend on the land for traditional livelihoods and cultural practices. The tribes worry the area is in danger of looting, vandalism, and the impacts of energy development. President Barack Obama established Bears Ears near the end of his presidency in 2016, but the next year, President Donald Trump reduced its size by 85%. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The South Dakota School of Mines and Technology recently held its commencement ceremony. As Richard Tubols reports, one student has become the 50th person to graduate under a unique program that supports Native students.
When Tristan Peacott was growing up in Eagle Butte on the Cheyenne River Reservation, he recalls one of his favorite pastimes.
I remember I'd take apart VCRs and DVD players and just like everything when I was little. And the electronics fascinated me.
That innate curiosity would play a big role in his future. His family moved around the United States, but he always longed to be back in South Dakota.
I have my family out here, my grandpa, my aunties, my cousins, my uncles. And, you know, moving around, I didn't get to see a whole lot of them.
And when he'd return for visits, the School of Mines started to play an important role.
If we drive by the school, my dad would always tell me, it's like, someday, that's where you're going to go. Someday, I want you to go there. And I think that stuck with me a bit more than I really paid attention to.
Peacott graduated from high school in Arizona and eventually set his sights on the South Dakota School of Mines.
I applied to 5 other schools across the nation. I got into all of them. But when it came down to it, the price was really attractive because you really can't beat price at Mines.
Peacott was initially overwhelmed when he first got to campus, but he met fellow Native Americans students and eventually learned about the Teoshpaye Scholar Program. The program is designed to increase the number of Native Americans graduating from Mines in the scientific fields of engineering and mathematics with the necessary financial and cultural support.
Those guys come from the same circumstances I do, and I see them as being really successful at it. And regardless of whether or not I was involved in that community all the time, they were still there to help me when I needed it.
Peacott walks away with his bachelor's in electrical engineering and has accepted a job with IBM, which starts in a few months. And as far as being the 50th Teoshpaye Scholar Program graduate,
it feels kind of weird. It's like, man, I just happened to end up at the 50th spot. It feels like a kind of a cool way to close that chapter of my life, you know?
Peacott looks forward to his future and says the Teoshpaye Scholar Program made it possible. He hopes to give back to his tribe someday, somehow, when the opportunity presents itself. In Rapid City, I'm Richard Tubels.
Tribal water rights settlements for the Navajo Nation and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes were enacted in the COVID-19 relief and government spending bill signed by President Trump Sunday. The spending package includes a number of provisions for tribes across the country for COVID-19 aid, funding for language programs and education, and funding for NAGPRA enforcement. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Now, National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
If you're a Native American expanding or starting a business, the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can make the business loan you need. Info by emailing dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program. Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians and the SAMHSA-sponsored Opioid Response Network, working across the nation to address the opioid crisis in tribal communities. Information and support at aaip.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. Today, we're remembering those who walked on in 2020. I know that there are some who do not wish to discuss death in accordance with your traditions. If that's you, you might want to skip this show and join us tomorrow. We want to spend some time honoring the lives of three significant Natives who died this year. They're just a few of the many people we lost this tragic and challenging year. But we can find comfort in acknowledging the health, education, and well-being they contributed to their communities and those around them. Today, we'll remember Nakota Lawrence. He was a world-class champion hoop dancer. He was Tewa, Hopi, Navajo, and Assiniboine. He was 30 years old when he passed in July. We're also remembering Maxine Racehorse Edmo, a longtime Native education and language revitalization advocate. She was Shoshone Bannock and was appointed to the National Advisory Council on Indian Education by President Jimmy Carter. We'll hear from her daughter about her life and legacy. But first, Eddie Benton Benet was one of the founders of the American Indian Movement. He walked on this year. To share about his life, we have Doreen Wabanukwe Day. She's a midwife and an activist and the sister of Benton Benet. And Doreen is Anishinaabe. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Doreen.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about Eddie.
Okay, well, there was, with such an extraordinary human being, there's much to tell. But I, first and foremost, he was the Grand Chief of our Three Fires Madewan Lodge. And that being said, had influenced the lives of many Anishinaabe across not only the U.S., but also in Canada. He was the author of the Mishumas book. The book was the first known documentation of our Anishinaabe way of being in the world, our language, culture, practices, clan system, value system, knowledge of the cosmos, our spirituality, essentially everything about being Anishinaabe. He was an educator. He was a father, having adopted many of his, beyond his own children. He was an uncle, a grandfather, a brother. He was a human being, always wanting the best for other humans. I think one thing to note is so important to me because it has affected my life and the good things in my life is he always wanted us as Anishinaabe to be able to live as Anishinaabe. He had many feathers in his hat. One was that he had a Master's of Indigenous Knowledge from the Seven Generations Institute in Ontario, Canada. He was always wanting to spread the Anishinaabe understanding of our life here on Mother Earth. And in doing that, he had a way of teaching. He invited you to learn. He wanted us to wake up our blood memory to reconnect with our ancestors in a spiritual way. Mm. Clearly, the spirit moved him to do these good deeds and good works. And then, therefore, those who engaged with him, that moved our spirit as well. One of the phrases that I remember hearing as a child growing up to be an adult in the lodge, he would always say, we have four natural laws. Gifted to us by the Creator. And he said, I'll tell you what they are. And he'd say, respect, 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 and respect. And I those are, you know, it's a beautiful saying, you know, beautiful way to look at how we should be in the world. I can't even imagine how many people that he named, given their Anishinaabe spiritual names to, or the amount of people that he really impacted in terms of their spiritual growth and their spiritual lives. It's a very big amount of people.
Well, let me throw that out there to our listeners. If you knew Eddie Benton Benet, he was one of the founders of the American Indian Movement, Anishinaabe, and you want to share a little bit about him, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Today, we're remembering those who walked on in 2020. And if you have something that you'd like to share, or if there's somebody that you lost this year that you'd like to just say their name on the air, tell us about them. We'd love to hear from you. The number is 1-800-996-2848. So, you know, Doreen, he was your brother, but I know that you mentioned that your mother adopted him. Tell us a little bit more about how he came into your life.
Okay. My mother moved to the Twin Cities from northern Minnesota in the late 60s. And at the time, I was a young girl. Of course, coming a single mother coming to, she wasn't single. My father was a hunter-trapper, stayed up north. And it was, I guess, like it was a separation, but it wasn't a separation. And so in that way, she came to raise her, to make a better life for us, to create a better life for her children. There were 7 or 8 of us at home at the time. But she came to the cities and began to seek out, you know, ways to help her family. And so meeting other Native people, of course, on the street downtown, they would say, oh, where are you from? When did you get here? Or, you know, they always looked out for other Native people. And so it's how she met him. They said, oh, go to this little Baptist church on Western and Central Avenue. They started an Indian office there. And all that time, it was the starting of the St. Paul American Indian Movement. And my brother was the director of that office. And he had other people. He had Tony Bender from Wisconsin. He had Billy Blackwell. Those were people that worked for the Indian community, and they provided support for housing, for legal issues, for, you know, help with food, you know, those types of things. And so my mother went there and she met him. And I remember walking in that little church that day, and he peeked over the desk and he said, who's this little person? You know, and my mom introduced us and I said, this is my youngest. And from that day, then I always, you know, knew about the work that he had done. And my mother was always supporting that work as a person who supported other Indian people. She supported them by cooking for feasts and, you know, just a number of different things. And the connection they had was they both spoke the language. And so my mother felt comfortable. And then a bond began between them and she adopted him as her son. In early 1971, they both talked about creating a Native school because Heart of the Earth in Minneapolis was already going. So they talked about that. And one day my sister got in real trouble at school and the authorities threatened to take her away from my mother. So my mother walked back down into the St. Paul American Indian Movement office and she said, we don't have more time to talk. We need to start our school today. So he did. And our first school was on that block with these trees and, you know, having school, having the Red Schoolhouse began at that time.
Oh, I would love to talk more a little about that. But, you know, for our listeners who might not know, what were the Twin Cities like back then for Native people? What were the challenges that you faced in those cities?
You know, it was a way to create better opportunities for children, but there were also the very unfortunately, it was very discriminatory for Indigenous people. It was a racist place to be. At that time, my mother joined the American Indian Movement. They were having protests for the dilapidated housing in Minneapolis. They were protesting the Indian men being put in trunks to be taken down to the police department. There were killings of Indian people in the city. There wasn't a fair anything. There wasn't fair education. There wasn't equal housing opportunities. There was just basically we were on our own. And so the Indian people banded together. So in the beginning times of the American Indian movement, there were so many challenges just to live in the city, even though many people were removed and placed by relocation. This was a time when my mother decided to try to live there for the betterment of her children, just like many other people did.
And what was Eddie Benton Binet's role in starting the American Indian Movement?
He was, first and foremost, he was an advisor to the American Indian Movement, the men who were on the front lines of the American Indian Movement. And how that began was actually in Stillwater State Prison. And that's another whole long story, but he connected there with Clyde Belcourt, and they were both in prison together. And he told Clyde Belcourt, one day we'll be in a lodge together and we'll be praying to our Creator as it should be. And, of course, that happened in their lifetime. And Clyde is a member of our lodge as well as his family. And so for them to bond together and for him to be in prison and to be okay with it and to sing his songs and do his prayers in a language like that was, you know, a lot of other young Indian men in prison at that time were not like that. So he was leading by example. There's a different way. There's something more to this, you know. So after they got out, they re-met again. And actually, Clyde went over to Chicago where Eddie was a high iron steel worker. And he talked him into coming to the Twin Cities to help the movement and help the people. So that's how that happened. Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Well, Doreen, we're about to go to a break, but I'd like to talk with you a little bit more after the break about the Red School House, if you have time. And today we are remembering those who walked on in 2020. We've been talking with Doreen Day about Eddie Benton Binet. He was one of the founders of the American Indian Movement. And if you have somebody that you'd like to remember today, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. This year, we lost our longtime host, Harlan Mikosoto. If you'd like to share a memory of him, you can give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. We're going to go to a short break, and after the break, we are going to talk more about those we've lost. Seasons of Alaska is giving the literary world an accurate representation of Native life in rural Alaska. The series of four baby board photo books is published by Best Beginnings Alaska Initiative. Each book features the creativity of four Alaska Native authors. Hear more about them on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You are listening to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. We're remembering those who walked on this year. Did someone you know die this year? Would you like to share a special memory of them? Join us and call right now. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. I've got Doreen Day with us. She's a midwife and activist, and she is the sister of Eddie Benton Binet, one of the founders of the American Indian Movement. Before the break, she was sharing with us he was so much more than just one of the founders of the American Indian Movement. And he and her mother started a Native-run school. Tell us more about it, Doreen.
Yeah, Red School House was really started out of the needs of the Indian students in St. Paul Public Schools who were, like, very discriminated against. And And it came to a point where my mother, who was raising us in the cities alone as a single parent, also working, was not an alcoholic, was not, you know, drinking or smoking cigarettes or anything like that. She was a very determined Indigenous woman just making a life for herself and her children. She, without having any knowledge of her and our home life, the school, because they discriminated against my older brothers and sisters, they would get into trouble for sticking up for themselves. And so one of my sisters was threatened to being taken away from my mother. And so the men that were in the legal department of the St. Paul American Indian Movement, they went with my mother to court. And here the social worker had fabricated that she was, you know, the family didn't have any food, the kids were not well behaved, you know, we didn't have any, you know, that my mother drank, and clearly that wasn't the case. And so they were able to stop that case from going forward. And it was just at some point my mother just said, you know, you talked about the school. We need an Indian school in St. Paul. Today is the day to do it. She told that to Eddie, and he agreed. He said, okay, we'll start our school today. So on that block where the little Baptist church was, it was the first location of the St. Paul American Indian Movement. They started the school that day. And then it grew, and the local community actually helped to, you know, to make that dream come true. We eventually got a school building, and the school flourished over time.
And you attended that school, did you, Doreen?
Yes, I did. I went from 7th to 12th grade, graduating in 1977. And then I also worked there for a period of time, and that education informed my life in so many ways, and it balanced and stabilized my way of thinking, my way of being an Anishinaabe person in today's life.
Mm. Well, Doreen, before we let you go, is there any memories or interesting stories you want to share about Eddie?
He was a singer, and he was a wonderful singer, and I remember being about 12 years old, and we were at a powwow at Battle Creek State Park, and I was maybe about 12. His wife, Delma, always sang at the drum with the singers, and I would go up, and I'd always go and stand with her. And in my mind, I knew the songs, but I just never let my voice go. And at that powwow, I went up. It was like every other time I went up and stood beside her while she was singing. And she looked at me during the pause, and she said, just sing. Just put it out. And so I did. And to this day, I'm still a singer. And I'm forever grateful for that. Eddie was a renowned singer. One of the things that he did was the ceremony songs from his grandparents and grandfathers and grandmothers, and he brought those into the future. And we have those today to connect us to our spiritual practices, which is a very phenomenal thing. He was a wonderful singer.
Doreen, thank you so much for joining us today to share about Eddie Benton Benet. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And today we are remembering those who have walked on in 2020. If you want to remember somebody, if you lost someone this year, give us a call. We want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now is Lorraine Edmo. She is the daughter of Maxine Racehorse Edmo, who walked on this year. And Lorraine is Shoshone Bannock. Welcome to Native America Calling, Lorraine.
Thank you very much, Monica.
You know, we were just talking with Doreen about the importance of education and starting the Red Schoolhouse in the Twin Cities, and it just made me think of your mother and what I've read about her and her commitment to education. And so what would you like to share about your mom?
Well, I would like to say that she was just a real advocate for not only our people, but for Native people nationwide. She was a real, what we would call a Bannock warrior woman. She was a real fighter for Indian people, and she lived all of her life on our reservation in Idaho. She was born right before the Great Depression in 1929, and she passed away in September, mid-September, when she was 91. But during her lifetime, she accomplished a great deal. She raised 11 children. There were 11 of us and 8 remaining. Before she went back to work or went back to school, she waited until my youngest brother, Gary, was about 6 years old before she went back, and she got her GED and got her associate's degree from Idaho State University. She had 6 sons, 5 daughters, and was married to my dad, Kesley, for more than 52 years. And he passed away in 98. But they worked together as a team to really better conditions for our tribe in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And as you mentioned, she was a true believer in Indian education. She encouraged all of us and her nieces, nephews, grandchildren, and other tribal members to get an education. She served in a number of capacities for our tribe. She was a tribal education committee member for about 10 years. She was a tribal councilwoman when she was, I think, in her 30s, and served a term on the tribal council. She was also a member of the Tribal Tax Commission, the Land Use Policy Commission, the Tribal Enrollment Committee. And but she really, I think the thing that stands out is her quest for education and for making things better for our people. Both she and my dad worked on getting the funding for a tribal center on the reservation back in the 70s, and got funding from the Economic Development Administration for that HRDC center, which is still used today. She advocated for our tribal school. It's the Chauvin Junior Senior High School, and she advocated for the money, for the funding for that for about 20 years. Every time she'd go to D.C. to attend meetings, either for the Bureau of Indian Affairs or Indian Health Service, she would try to make a point of meeting with congressional officials to talk about the need for the school. And it was funded finally in, I think, 1994, and then there was a groundbreaking in 1996. And now the school serves both junior and senior high school students there on the reservation, and the football field was dedicated in her honor several years ago. But it's a really nice facility that is located there on our reservation.
Lorraine, what do you remember about what she shared with you about education when you were growing up? Like, did she tell you that it was the most important thing, you know, to always get good grades? Or what would you like to share about that?
Well, what I remember growing up was she always encouraged us to stay in school, you know, even though it was the non-Indian system. She said that we needed an education to succeed in life, and but also to always remember our culture and where we came from. And every week we'd spend with our grandparents too, both her mom and dad, and my dad's parents, who would come up and visit all of us on the weekends. And but she always encouraged us to get an education, to stay in school, but, you know, to always remember where we came from. And so all of us did go on to get our high school diplomas. I think a couple of my brothers had to get their GED, but she, you know, we made them make sure that they did get their GEDs. So eventually, there were 7 out of the 11 who got BA degrees, and then 2 of us got master's degrees. And but she, you know, was a constant force in making sure that we, as well as other tribal members, went to school and made sure that we were successful at what we wanted to do. But
I was just going to ask you, why do you think there was so much emphasis on education? Did she ever share with you, you know, why it was so important?
Well, I think because she didn't get an opportunity to finish high school, she got married early and started to have a family. But then she knew that in order for us to succeed in southeastern Idaho and beyond, we'd have to succeed in the non-Indian schools. So she made sure that we all went to the public schools there that were located. There was one on the reservation, the elementary school, and then the non-Indian schools off reservation. So, you know, we'd have to catch the bus every morning to go to the high school and junior high. But she always, I don't know, she just felt a real need for us to get an education so that we would be successful in the world. And I think mainly because she didn't get an opportunity to finish high school, but then after we were all out of the house, she went back and got her GED, and then she got her associate's degree from Idaho State. And in getting that, she was on the dean's list when she got her associate's degree. But she always remembered, always wanted us to remember about, you know, caring for others, caring for family members and fellow tribal members on the reservation.
I love that. Hang tight, Lorraine. I want to talk to you a little bit more about your mom, but let's take a call. We've got Charlie in Fort Hall, Idaho, tuned in on KISU. Hey there, Charlie. What would you like to share today?
Good morning. I just wanted to talk about my mother. She passed away, I think, March 2nd, and she worked along with Maxine, you know, in the revitalizing the language and stuff. But she taught me how to about the medicinal plants and about the edible plants, and you know the songs like you got to know your language and your songs before you can even begin to know the plants and what they do for you, the different medicines. And I learned that, and some of the, you know, the words that she brought up were so advanced that, you know, I wrote some of them down, but I don't have the interpretation, and there's the loss there. But you know, like I tried to, you know, like she was in a wheelchair, and I tried to do my best to take care of her. And, you know, the different groups and, you know, throughout the reservation and the welfare, you know, they tried to dishonor me and discredit me so they could take her. And they took her into the assisted living center, and she lasted about a couple weeks, and then she passed away. And right after that, you know, like when she passed away, we had her funeral. There was just feathers falling out of the sky, and you know, and then about a week later, the COVID virus hit, and you know, everybody just started getting sick. And but you know, I made it almost a year now, and I feel pretty good. You know, I still have dreams of her. I think of, you know, the words she used to say, and I, you know, they're in my heart. And so,
Charlie, I'm so sorry for your loss, and thank you so much for sharing about your mother. What was her name?
Her name was Ramona Bell, and then her married name was Walima, but you know, her original name was Bell, and she was the last of the Bannock people, the full-blooded Bannocks in Fort Hall. And her dad was a medicine man that named Charlie Bell, and he ran the Sundances, and he took the Sundances up into Pryor, Montana, and to Wyola, Montana, and the Crows adopted that way, and they still practice all that, you know. And there was a guy from Wind River, a Trujillo, that worked with them, you know, and they, you know, in turn, you know, just... Powerful.
Yeah. Charlie, so sorry to cut you off because we're just about to go to a break, but I want to thank you so much for calling us today and sharing about your mother. And again, sorry for her passing. And Lorraine, what would you say is your mother's legacy for your tribe?
Well, I think her legacy is a strong belief in advocacy for Native children at both the local, state, and national level. She has 8 remaining sons and daughters who carry on her teachings to her children and grandchildren. And her legacy, I think, is that, you know, many of us have achieved higher level positions. I worked in D.C. for nearly 25 years at the Department of Justice and Education and Interior. One sister of mine, Louise, is a language and culture director. Another sister, Lori, was honored by the National Association of Journalists this past year for her work. We have a couple of former tribal council members who are her sons. Also, her grandchildren. One was just hired as an attorney with Native American Rights Fund in Anchorage. Another great-granddaughter just got her degree in business and accounting. I think her legacy is...
Lorraine, hang on one second. We've got to go to a short break. I want to hear more about your mother's legacy. We'll be right back.
If you're a Native American entrepreneur looking to expand or start up a business, you should know about the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program, a federal program encouraging private lenders to make the business loan you need. The Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can support you. Information available by emailing dci@bia.gov. That's dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, and today we are remembering those who've walked on in 2020. If you want to share, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And before the break, we were talking with Lorraine Edmo about her mother, Maxine Racehorse Edmo. And you were sharing, Lorraine, about her legacy. Go ahead, continue.
Okay. Well, I had mentioned her children and grandchildren. She had 23 grandchildren, 29 great-grandchildren, and 11 great-great-grandchildren. And she, you know, I think one of the important things that she left was, you know, her commitment and in advocating for the tribal school, and it's that stands as a testament of her work, as well as she was a founding board member of the Language Immersion School at Fort Hall, Chief Tagi Elementary School. She worked on what a lot of people don't realize is she did serve on a national task force in revamping the rules and regulations governing the BIA tribal and contract schools at the national level. She was a real advocate in working for the Affiliated Tribes Education Committee, the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians. She was real active with the National Congress of American Indians Education Committee, with the National Tribal Chairman's Association Education Committee when they were in existence in the 70s. She, as I mentioned, she does have, you know, grandchildren who are up and coming, and I'm sure will carry on her work in protection of tribal sovereignty and education. Her legacy of respect, I think, for tribal sovereignty, protection of tribal resources, will go on with, you know, through her children and grandchildren, because her spirit is with us always. And the need caring for others.
Thank you so much, Lorraine. We really appreciate it. And, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with you and your family as you go through the mourning process of missing your mom this coming year. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I also wanted to mention real quickly that another language teacher just passed away yesterday, Marceline Boyer. She was a fellow language instructor at Fort Hall, as well as Bobby Pivo, who was one of our traditional knowledge carriers. So, you know, it's just really sad that they're going. But thank you for having me on.
Yeah, we appreciate it, Lorraine. Thank you so much. And our condolences to your community. And if you want to join us today, we are remembering those who've walked on. There's still time. I'd like to just take a moment to remember Hannah Colton. She was the news director at KUNM and a friend of National Native News and Native America Calling. Hannah was an advocate for justice, and she fought against racism. I remember talking to her about podcasts and storytelling and how she got her dog to behave so well. And I want to just send out condolences to her family and to her partner. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got Gordon in Red Lake, Minnesota, tuned in on KOJB. Hey there, Gordon. What would you like to share?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about a very close friend and brother of mine who passed away, Bruce King, who was a musician, a playwright, a director, an incredible painter. And he taught at the Turtle Museum. He taught theater up there for some years, and he did a lot of things with radio and theater in New Mexico. We both went to the art school in Santa Fe together, and I just really miss him, and I just wanted to hope some of his friends and family are listening, that we will try to remember him as long as we can, and I just wanted to tell him thank you for all the things he did for us while he was here walking the earth with us.
Yeah, Gordon, thank you for letting us know about that. Bruce was a friend of the show as well, and he will absolutely be missed. Let's talk to Melvin in Santee, Nebraska, tuned in on KZYK. Hey there, Melvin.
Good morning. I met Eddie Benton in 1970. And one thing Eddie did in his life, he introduced thousands of young people to culture and their spiritual ways, encouraged it. And I would also like to recognize some women warriors that we just lost recently, Deb White Plume, Teresa Two Bulls at Pine Ridge, plus we lost a warrior, Tom Poorbear, who was the former vice president. Teresa was the former president at Pine Ridge. We lost them all to this virus and to other illnesses, and I would just like to recognize them.
Thank you, Melvin. We really appreciate it. Yeah, we know that there are so many more that we've lost this year, and in particular to this virus. And we'll be taking the time throughout the year to share a moment about them or to talk about them as well. Finishing up today, I'd like to bring in Steve Lawrence. He's the father of Nakota Lawrence, who walked on this year at age 30. Steve is Hopi and Assiniboine. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Steve. And I should also say that you are co-chair of the Lightning Boy Foundation, a Native American youth hoop dance group. Welcome back, Steve.
Good morning, Monica. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's. I wish it was under better circumstances. I remember Nakota early on when I first started working at Native America Calling. We had him on. I think he was like 16 or 17, and we had him as our native in the spotlight. And I remember that I was concerned that someone that young could talk for a whole hour, but he held the show and talked about hoop dancing and his life. And it was just a really special moment on our show. And so what would you like to share with our listeners about Nakota?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to send out my prayers for healing and strength to all of those who have lost someone beloved in their family like we did. Yes, Nakota was on the program a number of years ago, and he was about 15 or 16 at that time. And he was a real humble young man, and it was kind of difficult for him to do that because he didn't like being in the spotlight. That was something that he liked to put other people in the spotlight. But he loved representing Native culture through dance and through acting, and he was a very talented young man, and we're definitely going to miss him.
What are some of your fondest memories of him?
Well, you know, Nakota, he lived a full life in his 30 years, and he traveled all over the world to many countries representing Native cultures. He danced in front of millions of people, and his acting was seen by millions of people in some of the movies and films that he was in. But as I mentioned, he was always really, really humble. And one of the things I remember that we were invited to a table read in Albuquerque. And, we got to the table read, and there were a bunch of actors, and they were going around the table. They were all introducing themselves. And when it came to Nakota's time, you know, they're all introducing themselves as so-and-so, and I'm an actor, or so-and-so, and I'm an actress. And when it came to Nakota, he introduced himself, his name, and his tribe, and then he said he was a dancer. And everybody kind of looked at him like, you know, what's a dancer doing at an actor's table read? But that's what he really loved doing. He loved dancing. He didn't really like being on the big screen or being in, like I said, he was really humble. And so when he introduced himself as a dancer, that was just showing that that was his true love, dancing, and he just loved dancing. And so he really encouraged it among everybody he met. And he was particularly fond of the youth. And so he always wanted to give back to the youth. And that was his legacy in life, you know, not only representing Native culture, but also giving back to the youth as well.
Mm. Yeah, where did his love of hoop dance come from?
Well, just as a young boy, he attended powwows, and he met one of my friends growing up in the Hopi Mesas, a gentleman named Derek Davis, whom you've had on your program a number of times as well, and he was a world champion hoop dancer. And Nakota saw him hoop dance at a powwow and just fell in love with the art form, and, you know, at that time, he was really active, bouncing off the walls and everything. So it kind of was a way to focus his energy. And he just loved movement. You know, he loved the hand-eye movement coordination, and it was challenging to him. But it was also something that he rose up to and over the years became, you know, one of the well-known hoop dancers in the hoop circle, in powwow circles. And he was just known all over the world as a, you know, world champion hoop dancer representing Native culture. And so he had this boundless energy when he was very, very young. So it kind of helped focus him. And he achieved many things through his concentration on just focusing on that particular art form.
Mm. I know he got to hoop dance for the Cirque du Soleil. What can you share about that?
Well, when he was just getting out of high school, at the time we were living in Flagstaff, Arizona, I asked him, you know, I told him, I said, you know, hey, you're going to be out of high school in a couple months. What's your plans for the future? And, you know, he had a difficult time in school. You know, he was dyslexic when he was younger. And so it was always challenging for him, you know, to get through the academic part. But he had all of these other talents and strengths, you know, dance and acting and he rose above all of that, and he was able to travel the world, represent Native cultures, and his love for dancing just took him to places that
many of us will never go. And he met people. He was very, very humble, as I mentioned. You know, one time there was a magazine that wanted to use him and interview him on the front cover, and he graciously declined it because he said, well, there's other people out there that should be interviewed before me. And so he declined that. But he was really had a love for life and meeting people, and was so kind and compassionate to everybody he met.
Yeah, definitely. And are there any funny stories that you can share about Nakota? Anything that really, made you laugh?
Well, as I mentioned, when he was coming out of high school, I asked him what he wanted to do. And he said, well, I want to continue dancing and travel the world. And apparently somebody heard him, because he did get a call from Cirque du Soleil like about a month after us having that discussion. And he didn't know what Cirque du Soleil was about. And I had known about Cirque du Soleil for a number of years, because they were very, very big in Las Vegas, and that was only like about 4-hour drive away from Flagstaff. And, I hadn't gone to Las Vegas a lot, but the times that I had been there, I did see all the advertisements for the Cirque du Soleil shows. And so when they offered him a position with Cirque du Soleil, they wanted to let him know what Cirque du Soleil was about. And so they actually sent us tickets to a number of shows. And so we drove to Las Vegas, and we just spent the weekend, watching these Cirque du Soleil shows. And after the weekend was over, I looked at him and I said, well, do you think you'd like to work for them? And he was very, very enthused and said, yes, yes. And so he wound up flying to Montreal. And this is pretty rare, because Cirque du Soleil usually does auditions for their artists or performers. But they were actually calling him, because they were creating this new show called Totem. And they wanted to have a Native American representation in there. And they saw one of his videos on YouTube. And they were the ones that actually approached us about him participating in the show. And the rest is history. They tapped him to dance for the opening ceremonies of the Pan American Games, which was viewed by millions of people in 2015. So he was seen worldwide by millions of people, representing Native culture in the most humble and compassionate way, as should be.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share about Nakota and his passing and his legacy?
Well, as I mentioned, Nakota was a real human being. He was kind. He was humble. He was compassionate. He would, I traveled with him to many, many countries all over the world and different cities all across the United States. And he was always, looking out for the downtrodden. He would, give money to people that needed money, panhandlers, or he would want to help people out in any way he could. But he had a particular love for youth, and he would travel, all across the world trying to teach young kids, about the Native American hoop dance and its meaning. And he was very, very strongly aware of climate change and Mother Earth, because the hoop dance actually represents a healing of sorts. In its original form, it was a healing ceremony. So he knew that he always represented Native culture and our respect, our deep love and respect for Mother Earth and this planet and its climate. And so he often would, talk about that to youth, telling them that the representation of the contemporary hoop dance really is meant to bring awareness about the scarce resources of Mother Earth and saving the planet in any way we could, as well as encouraging the youth to be proud of their Native culture through dance and through art and through song. So he started two youth groups here in Northern New Mexico. One was the Pueblo of Powaki Youth Hoop Dancers. And then the second group that he started was the Lightning Boy Foundation, which honors one of his young dancers, one of his original young hoop dancers, a little boy named Valentino Sigueno Rivera. Sigueno in Tewa means lightning. And so when he passed due to a car accident, we decided to rededicate our youth group to his memory. So we created the Lightning Boy Foundation. But Nakota, wherever he traveled, his first thought was of his kids. And he would
thank
always
you.
Buy
them. So sorry to cut you off there, Steve. We've got to go. But thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Thanks to Doreen Day and Lorraine Edmo. We're back tomorrow.
Support by the Sanosky Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at ramonafarms.com.
Megwa and Webi Eg, Gogwejum Gidinaway Maganag in a Munji Owad, Gishbin Gikendaman in a Munji Owad, Nawaj Dweni Panad, and Akonagayan Yo Owaj Jagan the Gunawain Dagusian. Gnojeno Kid in a Shinabe Akwazi Wagamigung, Nawaj Jigikendaman, Mawadishiwain Healthcare.gov, Gema Gnoj 1-800-318-2596, Goundinagadeg, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.